Big chairs.
Good morning and welcome to this week of arguments in the 11th Circuit in Atlanta. Pleased to have Judge Anderson here with us for Macon, and we're also happy to be here in person with all of you. Just a couple of remarks before we begin. One is that please know, advocates, that we are familiar with your cases. We've read the briefs and the relevant parts of the record, and so you can feel free to go straight to the heart of your arguments. For those not familiar with our timing system, you'll see a green, a yellow, and a red light beside the timing clock. When the yellow light comes on, that means you have 2 minutes remaining in that segment of your argument. And when the red light comes on, we ask that you conclude your sentence or your remarks unless you're answering a question from the court, and in that case, we will give you extra time if necessary. Our first case of the morning is number 20-13074, United States versus Clowers. Mr. Dodson.
Good morning, Jonathan Dodson, representing Pinckney Clowers, and may it please the court. This appeal turns on what this court meant by the phrase could have been used when it held in Jones that the as-if clause of the First Step Act requires reviewing courts to determine, to calculate the post-Fair Sentencing Act statutory prison range based on any finding of drug quantity that could have been used to determine that range originally. That holding does not mean that a reviewing court is bound by any drug quantity that theoretically was capable of being used that way, because of course that would mean any drug quantity anywhere in the record is capable of being compared to the threshold quantities. It does not mean that the reviewing court must presume that a higher drug quantity was the basis of the statutory sentence, absent some explicit basis in the record to believe that it did so. That explains this court's holding in Jones with respect to Mr. Allen. Mr. Allen was serving a life sentence imposed after a jury found him guilty of an over 50 gram crack conspiracy with two prior felony convictions. He sought relief under the First Step Act, and the district court denied based on a drug finding somewhere in his record that he was responsible for between 420 and 780 grams per week. And this court reversed and remanded for two reasons, one of which was that the court, quote, might have incorrectly concluded Allen was ineligible because of the drug quantity finding. The same goes for Mr. Robinson's case. It was the same exact charge, a mandatory life sentence after a jury guilty verdict. This was a pre-Apprendi case.
Robinson is unpublished, right?
It is unpublished, correct. I would argue it is persuasive. It relied on the Allen holding that I just went over. And
the problem with your reliance on the Allen holding is that that drug finding of 420 to 784 grams was made by the First Step judge, not by the sentencing judge. In fact, the first time that finding was made was by 2255 judge, and then the First Step judge picked it up. But the crucial thing is that the sentencing judge did not make that finding. You apparently are not aware of that, I gather. Is that right?
That's correct. I believe, however, that the way that this court explained its holding, it didn't factor that procedural posture into it.
That's true, which is exactly right, because a later finding of a drug quantity by a 2255 judge or First Step judge doesn't count. The right. Only thing that counts is a finding by the sentencing judge, which did not happen in Allen's case. So frankly, you're not alone. The Robinson court misunderstood that also, and I think it's pretty clear in the Jones opinion itself that it was the First Step judge that made that finding and not the sentencing judge, but because the court used the phrase district court instead of sentencing judge, that's what misled, I think, the Robinson court.
I do recall it saying that it was the same judge resolving the first step motion who had, I believe, imposed the sentence in that. I'm sorry, that's Robinson. Excuse me. That was in Robinson. However, I do think that the way that the as-if holding was explained in Jones made the touchstone of that analysis whether the drug quantity could have been used to determine the statutory minimum.
As someone who sat on Jones, I think I'd call your attention to the Jackson disposition in that case, where the district judge did find a drug quantity. And in that case, we said for Jackson that for that reason, he was not eligible because the district judge at sentencing found the drug quantity. Whereas in Allen, as Judge Anderson points out, it wasn't until later on 2255 and then in the First Step Act that quantity was found. I think that's the distinction between the holdings with those two, with respect to those two defendants.
I think another distinction with respect to defendant Allen was that his guidelines range did not call for a life sentence. So because as he was sentenced to life, it had to be the higher drug quantity that triggered that life sentence. It wasn't a guidelines finding that did so.
I think you missed the point of Judge Grant's question. The holding in Jones with respect to Jackson actually forecloses your argument. Your argument, as I understand it, is that the only drug quantity finding of the sentencing judge that counts, in quotes, is that amount necessary to trigger the statutory penalty. The Jones decision's holding with respect to Jackson simply forecloses that argument because in Jackson's case, the jury found a certain amount. I can't remember whether it was 5 or 50. But the sentencing judge found 287 grams, and that 287 grams was held controlling and meant that even when the Fair Sentencing Act kicked in and made the the threshold went from 5 to 50, that it was still over that. The sentencing judge's findings were still over the amount, so he would have gotten the same sentence under the fair sentencing. So you understand that holding simply forecloses your argument?
I would clarify that what my argument is not that the courts always can only rely on the threshold quantity, but it's that there needs to be some basis in the record for concluding that the district court actually, the sentencing court actually relied upon that higher quantity in determining the statutory minimum.
There was nothing in Jackson's case any different from our case.
I don't know what the record showed in Jackson's case, but I do know that in our case that there was an entire hearing on the drug quantity, and with two defendants and two defense lawyers, and no one ever mentioned the statutory minimum. It would have been an easier matter to determine the 1.5 kilogram statutory threshold, but no one was focused on that. And that the only
before Apprendi, though, it didn't matter. What mattered to the judge was what the amount meant for the guidelines. And I think that's why in the earlier cases you'll see oftentimes no specific statement of a statutory finding, because it doesn't matter. That it's very clear that no matter what the amount is, it will meet the statutory threshold. Whereas once you get to the guidelines, it matters exactly what that amount is. So I think that's a relic of the way that cases were done at that time.
I can acknowledge it was certainly of less significance before Apprendi. However, theoretically, the court could have departed below from a guidelines minimum when it could not from a statutory minimum. So it would have been a better practice to have made both findings, and I'm not claiming that this would have been error on its own, but it's now under the First Step Act.
What year was this case, remind me?
It was 1992, I believe.
So well before Booker. It'd be pretty surprising before then to have a district court go below the guidelines.
I agree. And I would say that in this kind of case, where the First Step Act reflects a congressional intent to give district courts discretion to consider reducing sentences for a large number of crack offenders, the benefit of the ambiguity in the record, unlike in a 2255 where finality is paramount, the benefit of an ambiguity in the record should go to the defendant, should go to giving the district court the discretion that Congress intended the district courts to have. And I will rest there. Thank you.
Thank you. Ms. Scheiber.
May it please the court. The record really doesn't disclose any ambiguity. The district court, the sentencing court, had to make both a guidelines determination and a sentencing, a statutory penalty determination. And there's no reason to think that at that time that the district court was making two separate findings. The evidence that the district court heard at the sentencing hearing was evidence that was directly related to Mr. Clower's conduct. It wasn't like relevant conduct. It was exactly the kind of reflected the activities that the evidence at trial showed that he personally engaged in. So when the district court was making that more than 15 kilogram finding, there was no reason to think that he would have found a different number had he been required at the time to also make a separate statutory finding. And I think if I'm reading Robinson correctly, that's one way to distinguish Robinson, because the language in Robinson says that the indictment charged Mr. Robinson with 50 grams or more. And so when the jury made a finding of guilty in Mr. Robinson's case, they necessarily made a statutory quantity finding for him, or for his for purposes of the statutory penalties. Here, there was, so the district court in that case, or the sentencing court in that case, had no duty to make the statutory penalty determination. It had already been made. And that's if I'm reading Robinson correctly. The district court here, in this case, of course, it was only charged as he had an 841 and the 848, and there was no drug quantity in the indictment, as Judge Grant pointed out, because that was just never needed to be done at the time. And there was no drug quantity found by the jury. So the district court had to make a statutory penalty determination. And so I understand, you know, Mr. Dodson's suggestion that because it only had to be 1.5 grams for the 848, that we should just assume that that's all he found. But that's really not a fair reading of the record, because the amounts paired up in terms of what it found for the career or for the guidelines and what it found for the sentencing court. So not only does Jones compel that, you know, that the court could have made this finding, and so Jones would apply here. But I think that it's a fair reading of the record to say that he did make that finding.
Can you point me where specifically in the record the sentencing court used the 15 kilogram drug quantity to determine the statutory penalty as opposed to the guidelines range?
No. I mean, I don't think that's specific in the record that the court said, I'm making a statutory penalty determination. But at the same time, when you read the entire transcript, so I mean, you kind of got to piece it together. So if you look at the PSR, which of course they were all familiar with the PSR before the sentencing, and the PSR said more than 300 times And so the 848B mandatory life is going to apply here. So when they're at sentencing and they're all talking about, you know, what the drug quantity should be, and everybody stops at that 15 kilograms, at one point even Mr. Clower's attorney says, well, I understand there's no discretion here, Your Honor. And they're talking about the fact that he has a mandatory life sentence. So all of the parties are talking about this, not just in terms of the guidelines, but in terms of what the 848 determination is going to be. So it's not, I don't think in the record anywhere the court says, I make a statutory finding here.
Could you have gotten to Mr. Clower's ultimate sentence if you did not, if the penalties, if the 848B penalties and the guidelines sentence didn't match up? I know that doesn't sound like a very clear question. I'm trying to think of how to put it better. But isn't the statutory determination a necessary first step to what Mr. Clower's guideline sentence ended up being?
Well, I'm not sure, Your Honor. Yes, I think a statutory, I mean, I think, that's the framework, right? Because
right.
You can't go any higher, you can't go any lower. So that's
right.
Your framework. You do have to start with that. And when you look at the way the PSR structured it, you know, it's said, you know, count one is 10 to life. So, and that was the drug quantity. So the judge had some playroom in there. He didn't have to sentence. I looked at the PSR, and I don't think he had to sentence Mr. Clowers to life under count one. So he had a 360 to life on him. So he did have to, is how I remember understood it. And I think that differs from Mr. Dodson's understanding. But so he had some room in there on count one to go 360 to life. So he had to make a guidelines determination as to him. But he had no room under the 848. And so when they're all talking about, judge, you have no discretion here, they're all talking about 848 is how I understood it. But the point being that he had to make both determinations. And he didn't have to, at the time, he didn't have to say which one he's finding. But it isn't realistic from the record to think that he would have found a lesser quantity for the statutory determination than he found for the guidelines determination. So, if the court has no more questions, I
do have one question.
Okay.
You filed a 28J letter where you talked about a Supreme Court case called Concepcion, and I just didn't understand the tension that you were pointing out between the government's argument in that case and Jones.
Well, so the government takes the position in Concepcion that the district court, looking at a First Step Act motion, can take into consideration changes in sentencing law that have occurred since the date of sentencing. And as relevant here, that would be, most relevant here, that would be an Apprendi determination. And so the government's position in Concepcion is that when Congress created the First Step Act or enacted the First Step Act, it did it within the framework of current law, and that Congress intended for current law to apply. And that differs from Jones in that Jones says that as if language in Section 404B requires you to look only at, to plug in only those drug quantity amounts and nothing more. So you wouldn't take in changes in law, such as Apprendi, in determining the eligibility is probably not the right word, because if it's a covered offense, he's eligible, in making your discretionary determination of whether to reduce that defendant's sentence. So under the government's position in Concepcion, the district court, who has a defendant with a covered offense in front of him, can actually look at the fact that this was a judge-made drug quantity determination and not a jury-made drug quantity determination, and can take that into consideration in determining whether or not he's eligible for a reduction in sentence.
The government's position, as I understood it, which was, I think, a little bit confusing, and some of the justices seem to think so too, was that it was a may, but didn't have to, but sometimes must. It wasn't totally clear to me.
I take it you listened to the oral argument.
I did.
I took a few minutes to listen to it as well, and it's difficult to articulate, but I will say this. I think that under the government's analysis, if it were to win the day in Concepcion, I believe that the district court could then disregard the sentencing court's judge-made finding in Clowers in deciding whether or not to reduce his sentence. I mean, I've conferred with the folks at the department based on Concepcion, and that's what they've told me, that because they believe that even though that as if the language is in there, they believe that the judge shouldn't disregard constitutional sentencing changes that have taken place since that a particular defendant was sentenced. So that's the reason I brought it to the court's attention, because it's possible that Concepcion could be the decision that the Supreme Court takes, or excuse me, that the government's position could be the position that the Supreme Court takes in Concepcion. If you listen to the oral argument, you might have an opinion on whether that'll win the day or not, but it's something. And the other hope from Concepcion is maybe there'll be some more guidance. That might sort of trigger how courts are supposed to analyze these. I don't know. But I bring it to the court's attention only to let you know that it's a slightly different, it's a different position than I think would apply here under Jones. And it could be relevant.
Thank you.
Anything further?
Nope.
Thank you for your time.
In response to the government's argument that the record doesn't anywhere conclude how, and I'm paraphrasing, I hope I don't get it wrong, how the sentencing court determined the statutory minimum, I would point the court to paragraph 163 of the PSR, where it's the only reference in the entire record to how the statutory penalties were calculated, and it uses the threshold amount, the 300 times 5 grams. That is where you might expect to see a larger amount to be if that was in fact the basis of that statutory minimum. With regards to the Robinson jury verdict, it seems very likely that at that trial there was evidence, and I don't know this for sure, of something more than exactly 50 grams of crack cocaine. So when the jury's deliberating, they probably had in mind this larger quantity when they're making this guilty decision. Nonetheless, it was the threshold amount that was the basis for the statutory minimum, and I think that could apply in this context as well. Certainly the judge is aware.
I hesitate to even bring up an unpublished case, because I've often joked that at every CLE I speak at from henceforth, I will say that I've learned since I've been on the 11th Circuit that the belief that unpublished opinions are not precedential is dramatically stronger than I had ever imagined as a practitioner. So I'll caution you that unpublished opinions, at least speaking for myself, but this is what I've picked up from many of my colleagues, are it's as if they're not there. But I will say, since we're talking about Robinson, Timmons goes the other way. So I think really if we're going to look at unpublished cases, we wouldn't come out with an answer, no matter what we hold here, it'll be inconsistent with at least one of our unpublished cases. Are you familiar with the Timmons case?
I am. Okay. I am. In that case, I fall back on Allen, and I do understand the distinction that Judge Anderson's point out there, but I think the same thing would apply in terms of the jury likely was aware that there was more crack involved in that case, but it was the jury verdict of 50 grams or over that triggered the statutory minimum. And the same would apply here. Certainly the judge is aware that there's more than 1.5 kilograms involved, but that section of the PSR that the court adopted just used the trigger amount to explain how it came to the statutory minimum.
Well, you know, actually, in Jackson's case, in the Jones decision, the jury also found more than 50, in that the indictment charged 50 or more. The verdict was silent, but they had to find guilty. They had to find at least 50. So you had the jury verdict of more than 50, and then you had the judge's finding of 287, and the court, Jones, went with 287.
That's correct, and I think, and I'm sorry if I'm misunderstanding the distinction you were drawing, but I do think that the important part there is that the guidelines themselves didn't mandate life for Mr. Jackson, so it had to be the 287 grams as the basis for the statutory minimum of life.
At the time, 50 would have done at sentencing, and then at first step, it would have required 280.
Right.
And because it was 287, the as-if clause meant that he was not eligible.
I understand, Your Honor. would also point out that a statutory finding wasn't, in this case, necessary to impose a life sentence because it was authorized under 848A. Of course, the court was very clear that this was an 848B offense in the PSR, but it didn't have to make that finding to impose life. So in closing, the district court expressed that it believed that Mr. Clowers was deserving of the legislative grace that the First Step Act allowed, and I would ask that this court reverse and remand so that the district court can reconsider whether to reduce Mr. Clower's sentence. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Our next